Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's midday at the movies. Anne Hornaday, the film critic of the Washington Post, joins us from the Toronto Film Festival as the race to the Oscars and other awards begins its post-summer surge. Toronto is one of the biggest festivals in the world, and its audiences have an uncanny ability to pick award winners. Jed Dietz, the founder of the Maryland Film Festival, joins us as well with tips on what to see this weekend in local theaters. Plus, Jaywin Russick surveys what's ahead in this season's theatrical offerings. I'm Tom Hall. Midday starts after the news. And welcome, everybody. It's Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall. Good to have you with us today. As summer comes to an end, the race for the Oscars and other awards gets underway in earnest. The Toronto Film Festival got underway this morning, along with festivals in Telluride, Venice, and New York. Toronto is considered one of the biggies for introducing films that producers hope will be top contenders. Anne Hornaday is a film critic for the Washington Post, and she joins us from the aforementioned Toronto. Hey, Anne, how you doing?
Hi, Tom. Great. I'm in Toronto. What could be better? It's wonderful. We're all psyched.
Indeed. Lots of movies to watch. And joining me here in the studio is Jed Dietz. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Hey, Jed.
How are you?
So, by the way, folks, our conversation was recorded yesterday, so we can't take your calls and comments today. But, Anne, Toronto Film Festival is a big deal. You wrote a piece about this in the Post a few days ago about last year's Oscar Best Picture winner, Green Book, and it seemed to sort of make the big leap at the Toronto Film Festival.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. It won the audience award last year, and even though I was not at that particular screening, I didn't catch up with it until the Middleburg Festival, but the enthusiasm for that movie was just pouring out, and you could hear it on the street, you could hear it with people in line. People just absolutely fell in love with that movie, and then, like I said, it went on to win that audience award, which has really become something of a bellwether for Best Picture winners. And I think it, up until that, maybe not up right until that moment, but I think throughout the year, the parent studio, Universal, had assumed that First Man would be their big Oscar picture because it has all the contours of a traditional Best Picture competitor.
There was a Ryan Gosling thing, right? Yeah.
Exactly. The Ryan Gosling playing Neil Armstrong. It was just this magnificent narrative, special effects, epic story, historical importance. It just has, you know, it kind of checked every box for a traditional Best Picture winner. But I think when Green Book showed that it just had such, it made such an emotional connection with people, that's when a lot of people with the studio and their awards consultant knew that it could probably go the distance, which it ultimately did. So Toronto's definitely been, it's become kind of a kingmaker in that way. And I think part of it is that, you know, the audience award is a populist award. It's not a critics award. It's not film snobs. It's people who go to movies and love movies. And I think what that tells us is that the Academy is more that way than not. You know, I mean, I think we make a lot of assumptions about Academy voters and that they, you know, they behave one way or another, but I think at the end of the day, they're more like garden variety film goers than we often realize.
That's interesting. And Jed, there really is a hierarchy kind of the festivals. I mean, I mentioned not only Toronto, but Telluride, Venice, New York. You go to Sundance every year, Anne goes to Toronto pretty much every year.
And we have people at Toronto right now and South By, we're certainly paying attention to all these festivals.
Yeah. So there's 300 movies over 11 days at Toronto, and Anne will see all of them and duly report back. And we very much appreciate that because tonight's my bowling night and I couldn't do it. But how does 300 compare to, you know, the other ones, to the New York or Telluride or Venice or even Maryland Film Festival?
So it's much bigger than Maryland, both days and number of films. In attendance and films, it's one of the biggest film festivals on earth, quite a bit bigger than Sundance. Probably Sundance is like 120 feature-length films, so smaller, and many more attendees at Toronto. And it's also very interesting what Anne just said about the award. This audience award at Toronto is the only award I can think of at any film festival, jury or audience, that actually does correlate with commercial success of a film. Mm-hmm. And you go back to Princess Bride.
It's like the ultimate focus group, yeah.
Well, and maybe because of the size of the audience, maybe because the Toronto Film Festival from its beginning has always had a strong local audience, whereas Sundance audiences all come in, can all come in from overseas and other states. I'm not sure why, but you can really see a pattern with a Toronto Audience Award.
So, Anne, you, of course, are the author of the number one hit bestseller, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Do you think it's the fact that the Canadians have all read your book that makes them so erudite and astute? I mean, that's the only thing I can
That's got to be the key variable, yeah. Right there.
Yeah. No, it's the opposite. I aspire to have their discernment. I mean, they are a wonderful audience, I will say. Like, I spend a lot of time going to press screenings. They have these press and industry P&I screenings for we grubby, ink-stained wretches and cynics. But it's really nice to go to the public screenings, and that's when you end up standing in line for 45 minutes to get in, and it winds around the block, and that's when you talk to people. And you hear what people are seeing, and you hear what people are loving. And they're just, it's an enthusiastic audience. They love movies. They love to explore. They go in wanting to like things. And they go in really as blank slates. I mean, in other words, they don't have their elbows out. You know, they're not saying prove it. You know, they're really meeting the filmmakers and their work halfway. And I think it's a lovely spirit in which to engage. You know, I sincerely do try to be that way in my own work, but it's just a very, this festival's been around for, 30 or 40 years now, and you can really tell that they've nurtured this audience. The audience has come along with them. It's very similar to what Jed's been doing with the Maryland Film Festival. It's such a two-way street, and it's really exciting to see it come to this kind of fruition.
What about its importance on the business end? I know at Sundance, it's a real market. People are there looking to pick up distribution deals. Is it the same at these other four big festivals, including Toronto?
No, they're all a little bit different. Everyone has their own sort of niche and brand. And I would say the thing about Toronto is what we started talking about. I think it does have not just a film community crowd, but a crowd from the streets of Toronto. From the beginning, this has been true. And sure, they're there to see the premiere screenings where there are movie stars and stuff like that. I mean, that's all fun. But I think what Anne's describing is exactly right. I think there is real film culture, largely due to the TIFF organization, the Toronto International Film Festival organization, which now has theaters year-round, et cetera. But they've built an audience, and there's a real film culture that isn't just film people. It's sort of lawyers and accountants, and et cetera, who take some time off and go to movies during TIFF. And I think that has made a difference. And it's got to be something like that that separates this audience award from others.
Yeah, and I know I've asked you this before, but it's always fascinating to me because just as an attender, you know, an attendee of the Maryland Film Festival, Linnell and I pour over the schedule and say, what do we want to see? How do you decide as not only a critic and a movie lover what you're going to see? I know if it were me, because I'm a person with no moral compass, I would just accept bribes. But I assume you don't do it that way. So how do you pick? You got 300 movies. How many do you think you're going to see over the course of this weekend? Or
can I tell you, I am literally, as we speak, I have the schedule in front of me, and I take my magic marker and I circle the things I want to see. I just want to read to you what my options are all at the same time on Monday morning, and then you tell me what I'm supposed to see.
Oh, I love bossing people around. Okay, fine.
I could see Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story, which has been getting absolute raves out of Telluride, and I think Venice. I'm not sure if it was at Venice. But
yes, it was also
at Telluride. Yeah. I can see Taika Waititi's Jojo Rabbit, which is having its world premiere here, which is this crazy-sounding revisionist comedy about Hitler, which you don't usually have those words all in the same sentence. I could see The Goldfinch, John Crowley's adaptation of the best-selling novel. I mean, that's the kind of stacking that they do here, to the point where people actually get a little bit mad, because it's like there's just too many interesting sounding things to see all at once.
Yeah.
And another kind of dilemma, at least for me, is that what I want, these are all big, high-profile movies, and I feel sort of obligated to see those, but at the same time, you want to see smaller things that might not even have distribution yet, that one can maybe champion. I mean, I remember seeing The Hurt Locker here and wanting to just shout from the rooftops about it, which I tried to do, and The Visitor, Tom McCarthy's wonderful movie. So I want to make sure I make room for those, because that's actually the best part of any festival is discovery.
Sure, and Jed, you have the same dilemma when you go to Sundance, or
Absolutely.
Even when you go to the Maryland Film Festival.
Yep.
Now. I mean, if it were me and I've given those choices, I would curl up in a fetal position and watch the Emoji Movie on the hotel room. Okay, that's what I would do.
No, you wouldn't. You'd pick one of the other ones. But so I'm recommending Jojo Rabbit of that group, just mm-hmm. because I think you'll be courted for marriage. I mean, I think you're right. That's already,
exactly.
That's a known thing. You'll get to see that, and probably they'll be pitching you for features. And JoJo could be phenomenal, or who knows, you know?
Yeah, it's,
well, and JoJo is, like I said, it is the world premiere. Well, and so is The Goldfinch, actually. Both
yep.
of them are having their premieres here, and so that's always fun to be really, truly the first, you know, among the
yeah.
first people
and,
to see
And
something.
Two movies with Scarlett Johansson out of that group.
There you go.
True.
All right, tough choices, but we'll hear about them, I'm sure, in future segments of Midday at the Movie. So, Jed, in terms of the summer is over, and now we're really into Oscar season. People, mm-hmm. as we've talked many times before, load up the ones they think are going to have a chance at an Oscar towards the end of the year, because, you know, who can remember last week, let alone last January? So how was the summer? I mean, I understand that the numbers at the box office are a little bit deflated from last year, but not terribly so.
Yeah, summer was down about 2%, and summer in movie terms is Memorial Day to Labor Day. And the odd thing is that it was like the whole year has been really dominated by Disney. They've done 40% of the box office.
40%?
Yeah.
To one studio?
Yes.
Wow.
And that's throwing everybody off. And they also have just bought Fox, so they've got all of Fox movies coming in. Those are not yet counted. Fox has not had a very successful year, but of course it's a hugely valuable library. I mean, Disney hopes hugely valuable. But the Disney movies have done very well. A lot of the other supposed big ones have really fallen. There have been some smaller movies like Yesterday that has done very, very well. Other smaller movies that got great critical reception. Both Ann and I loved a movie called Booksmart that did not do very well. So it's one of these great things. It's an art form, very much a business, but an art form. And
Booksmart, you know, it's funny, Jed, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Booksmart, although I think we can agree it didn't find the audience it deserved, it actually chugged along. You know, it hung out in theaters for quite a while, and I think it sort of slowly but surely made some pretty respectable numbers, even though, like I said, I don't think it wasn't as much as it deserved, but I'm not sure it was the abject failure that a lot of people, you know, are saying that it was.
No, totally fair.
You on that?
No, totally fair. I mean, I just think it had such energy as it came in. I think they were really hoping for more. And I think you're right, and this happens often in this art form. Things will live over time in a way that they don't mm-hmm. when they first come out. There's a art wonderful.
And it will probably do very well. I was actually in my conversations with people. Titles like that tend to do really, really well when they show up back, you know, on streaming and home video. You know, I think that's when reviews can actually help again, if they didn't the first time, when people kind of do check out Rotten Tomatoes and go, oh, okay, let's try it. So I think there's still hope, even though, like, we wish it had gotten what it deserved.
And Anne, you wrote a piece about the recurring theme of nostalgia in a lot of movies, particularly musical nostalgia, which is interesting. I mean, there was an Elton John movie. There was a movie that had the music of Bruce Springsteen. Yesterday had the Beatles. There was one about Marianne and Leonard, a Leonard Cohen movie. And now there's one about the Laurel Canyon scene with David Crosby. Mm-hmm. So it is a bunch of aging hippies, you know, in the 50th anniversary of Woodstock here. We're all going to the movies to relive our sordid youth.
And God love y'all for it. Well, you know, in one way, I think with the documentaries, it's definitely an attempt to get these people while they're here. You know, I mean, I feel like there's, and I can understand it. It's like, oh, quick, God, you know, David Crosby, what a great storyteller. Get a camera on that guy and let him go, which is what they did, and it was wonderful. And I do look back and think, you know, Mamma Mia, and obviously Bohemian Rhapsody, the writing's on the wall, that these things are just boffo, huge successes. Strangely, as Jed said yesterday, really did quite well. Rocket Man didn't get to Bohemian Rhapsody numbers, mostly because Bohemian Rhapsody was a PG-13, family-oriented, right, fun, you know, really fun movie. Rocket Man was a little darker. It was R-rated, and so it just never, it would never have made those numbers just based on its, you know, on its approach and its tone. What I was disappointed in was that more people didn't see Blinded by the Light, because I think of all of those music-oriented nostalgia trips, it's probably the most original.
And that's the Springsteen meaningful one, we should remind folks.
Yes, and it's based on a memoir of a young Pakistani-British guy who was feeling really dislocated and just not quite British, not quite Pakistani. He was having problems with his dad. And when he discovered the music of Bruce Springsteen, the world just opened up, and he found his voice, and he found his writerly voice, and he found his tribe. And it's just the most moving, meaningful. You know, so it's not just a jukebox musical. There's meaning to it, and frankly, there's a lot of timeliness, because the movie touches on issues of immigration and the National Front. This is all taking place in 80s England, but it is, you know, sadly, very relevant to today. It was directed by Gurinder Chadha, really nicely done. It's just a lovely little movie, and it kind of got lost in the August doldrums. You know, that's when so many movies out that month, and it kind of got a little bit lost.
But of course, all of these movies will eventually end up being available to stream, so we can all view them on our watches in no time. Anne Hornaday is a film critic for the Washington Post. She's the author of an excellent moviegoer's guide called Talking Pictures: How to Watch Movies. Jed Dietz knows how to watch movies. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. I'm Tom Hall. I'm along for the ride. It's Midday at the Movies. We'll have more with Jed and Anne after this quick break. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday at the Movies. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday on the Arts. We're going to meet the legendary jazz impresario and producer Todd Barkin, who recently opened the Keystone Corner Jazz Club in Baltimore. It's the first large-scale jazz club to open in our city in 3 decades. It's a terrific place. You should get down there if you haven't already. Plus, Sid Wolf, she's the executive producer of Baltimore's annual Marinari Arts Festival, along with the celebrated chalk artist Carlos Alberto Garcia Hernandez. And he'll be one of the dozens of international street artists who are showing off their talents at this weekend's festival. So they're going to join me to talk about that. Plus, the world-renowned classical guitarist Piotr Piakoman plays for us live in Studio A. So that's coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, as I mentioned, it is the September edition of Midday at the Movies. Jed Dietz is here with me in the studio. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and joining us from the Toronto Film Festival, Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take your questions or comments on the air, but as always, you are welcome to reach out to us on Twitter at Midday WIPR. So let's talk about a couple of the movies that are currently in the cinema. Let's listen to a clip. This is from a movie called After the Wedding. Michelle Williams' character has just shown up late for the wedding of a person who's a potential benefactor's, the daughter of a potential benefactor. So the donor's husband checks her out and approaches her, and she's got this incredibly panicked look on her face. This is after the wedding.
What are you doing here?
Hi, good, you made it.
I was a little bit late. I missed the first part of the traffic.
That's okay, you're here now. That's all that matters. You met my husband? Yeah? So Isabel runs an orphanage in India that I'm thinking of funding.
Oh.
Yeah. And so I thought it'd be nice if you could come.
Mom, should I change my dress before dinner?
No, because people like to see the bride in a beautiful dress. It looks so good. This is our daughter, Grace. This is Isabel.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful dress.
Grace, let's go double check that playlist before it starts, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Cool. Hey, I'm glad you could make it.
Thank you for having me.
After the wedding. So, Jed, I don't know, this sounds like, you know, typical wedding banter, but tensions are high. Huh?
Yeah, it's not at all typical. This is a remake of a Danish movie that was Denmark's foreign language submission to the Oscars in 2006, directed by a woman named Susan Beer. This is directed by Julianne Moore's partner in life, husband, Bart Frohnlich. And they've reversed the roles. There were two men in the lead roles, the philanthropist, potential philanthropist, and the person running the orphanage in India were both men. In this case, they're both women, played by Julianne Moore and Michelle Williams. And I really don't want to give anything away because it's full of twists and turns. But they're beginning at that scene.
Anne, what'd you think?
Well, I really admired the craft of it, and definitely a chance to see Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore at the top of their respective games. They are both superb in this movie. This is a melodrama, and I think for people who love that genre, it's a very well-executed one. It gets a little too contrived for my taste, a little too schematic and kind of... But that's, again, that's kind of part of the genre. Those are the genre conventions, so I don't want to criticize it for doing what it's trying to do, you know? It's just not, those aren't my favorite kinds of narratives or my favorite kinds of movies. So I'm a little bit mixed just because of my own personal taste, but I do think it was very well done.
Yeah, and Julianne Moore, Michelle Williams, they are terrific actors.
And Billy Crudup playing the husband. The thing I really agree with what Anne has said. I would say what makes it awkward, I think in 2006, there's a great issue about inequality in the movie, Western nation Denmark or the United States in this case being obviously very wealthy, and the scene's very wealthy, and then this person coming from working with very poor people in India in this orphanage, the contrast is very clear. And in 2006, that might have, I think was, I remember the Beer movie was sort of an insightful, interesting contrast. Now it's almost ludicrous, and they can't quite... the script actually makes it worse, to be honest with you. But it's, I mean, it is literally almost laughable in points where I think it's not meant to be at all.
All right. Well, so we have reached my favorite part of the program. That's the part of Midday at the Movies in which we talk about a movie that I have actually seen. the dozens of people who listen to the program know that I live
a
pathetic life.
We need a special musical cue for this. This is amazing.
I don't get out often because, as I mentioned, the dozens of people who listen to this program know that I live a pathetic life, and Luke and I spend a lot of time working on our stamp collection. However, I did go to the Maryland Film Festival. Perhaps you've heard of it, Jed. And I saw this great movie called Loose, which is about this high school athlete. He's an all-star. He's a very accomplished kid. He's very smart. And he's... He gets himself in a little trouble. So here's a little clip from Loose. So this is he's adopted, by the way, and the teacher, who's played by Octavia Spencer, and Loose is a person of color, comes from Africa, is explaining to his mother, who's played by Naomi Watts, why Octavia Spencer, the teacher, is a little worried about Loose.
I won't pretend to know what it's like for Loose to confront certain aspects of who he is. And it's not within my purview to say what a boy who spent his first 10 years in
Eritrea,
right, what that might have been like, what kind of adjustments he must have made in order to fit in here. And I don't know the details of his treatment.
Well, I'm sure you've heard he went through years of recovery and he showed no signs of...
I didn't mean to imply.
I just want to be clear that whatever violence he both suffered and inflicted during that time was... dealt with. It's been processed.
Of course. but with the climate around school security the way it is right now, you can understand my concern.
Yes.
Which is why I felt I needed to search his locker.
I'm sorry.
So that's what happens. She searches the locker. They find stuff they don't want to find, and then chaos ensues. So, Jed, you chose this as the closing film for this year's film festival.
Well, I'm retired, so I didn't choose it.
You didn't choose it.
But the team did.
People who are just like you in every way chose it.
Lots of diversity, actually, around the whole screening committee. So it's great to because we were championing a young filmmaker himself, a Nigerian, so new to the West. There has been quite a vibrant Nigerian film community. Films we've been.
This is Julius Ona.
Ona, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. He gathered an incredible cast. You mentioned Octavia Spencer. Naomi Watts is in that scene. She's married to Tim Roth, the great English actor. It's just coming out now. We'll see how it does in the marketplace. But it was at Sundance and coming through the festival circuit.
Yeah, and I was really taken with this movie. How about you?
Same. And it's funny because after kind of accusing After the Wedding of being contrived and twisty, this is also has its own share of contrivances and tricks, but it's so beautifully calibrated. And I just thought every performance was completely right on. And I am blanking on the name of the young actor who plays Luce.
Kevin Harrison Jr.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. I mean, just a really stunning, stunning debut on his part. It was, I believe, a stage play and adapted by Julius Ona, who now takes place in a Northern Virginia, very affluent community high school, which is similar to the community where he came of age. And I just think it has such a grounding in truth and lived truth and experience. And has so many nuances that it's dancing with. I was really impressed with this movie.
Yeah, I was impressed with it, too, because it handled the subject of race really sensitively and with a really nuanced, interesting, complicated way, which is what race is. It handled the notion of adoption and, the making of family and the keeping of family together really in a nuanced and complicated way. And it handled the notion of marriage really interestingly. It handled the notion of professionalism and teaching and everybody's individual stories came out. I just thought this was a really, really beautifully done, too. I know Linnell and I both really liked it a lot. So Luce, that's now at the Charles Theater, that one and After the Wedding, both at the Charles. Over at the Parkway Theater, we want to talk about one called The Nightingale. This is a horror film or something, right? I saw the preview for this, the trailer. There's no way I'm going to go see this movie. I hate to tell you, but boy.
No, it's... And if you reacted that way, you shouldn't see it because the film is a one of the guys in the theater told me as I walked in, he said, it's a strong cup of coffee. And it's true. what's interesting about this is in a way a standard sexual assault vengeance horror film.
And it takes place in Australia in 1825.
Tasmania in 1825, exactly. And it's directed by a woman who grew up as a trained actor. She has made a film that broke through last year, another horror film called Babadook. And she's getting looked at because she's dealing with very issues of real violence, sexual assault in this film. But through a woman's eyes, and you can, although it hits a lot of the notes that horror films hit, you see that. This one also, because it's 1825 Tasmania, there are issues of colonialism and race in this that are very fascinatingly done. We just talked about it with Luce, because you're seeing the white world coming into Tasmania and pushing the Aboriginal world into a very tiny corner, if not to extinction, and the presumption that the Aborigines are people are not people is confronted in this movie in this very much standard horror film in many ways, but the issue of race also in this one comes up in a very interesting way.
And Anne, I have this on high authority because I think you told me this a couple of days ago that people actually walked out of this movie at the Cannes Film Festival, which is interesting.
I don't think it was at Cannes. It was at the Sydney Film Festival because
Australia. Yeah.
Well, and my understanding is that the scenes of sexual violence, and they're just brutal. I mean, there's no other, you know, as well they should be because, you know, brutality is brutal. And I just think it's fascinating that we'll sit there and take whatever Quentin Tarantino gives us and not blink an eye. And somehow when Jennifer Kent does it, you know, in the name of historical precision and emotional connection, then that's just too much and people have to leave. I found that to be incredibly hypocritical on the audience's part. She is a masterful filmmaker. I think between The Babadook, which I was a huge fan of, and in this movie, there's no question that she has chops and she can execute at a very high level. Again, I think my only problem with this movie is really the genre, which is a revenge movie. It reminded me a lot of what my reservations about The Revenant, which is that it's a linear narrative. It's going to, you know, there's this person on this journey to get one thing, and after a while, it does become a little monotonous and repetitive. And I found that kind of limited it. I do think she tries to play with that a little bit, and she subverts our expectations about how that's all going to go, which I really appreciated. I think she's absolutely brilliant, and I want to see more from her. This might not be my very favorite Jennifer Kent movie, but I just think she's a star. I mean, I'm so happy that she's among us and making movies.
Yeah. And that's the thing about the Parkway Theater is the kind of place that's going to show this kind of movie. The other thing is there is a documentary, which we don't have time to talk about, but it's called Honeyland.
Oh, it's a must.
And it's about this mother and her daughter, I guess, who live in rural Macedonia. Just quickly, tell us what's about.
So this woman who has been sort of abandoned by her family through tradition is a beekeeper, but of bees in nature. And she also has to take care of her mom, who's older and ill. And it's a story shot in the most extraordinary way, pure documentary and great, great talent from these two young Macedonian filmmakers, and a totally involving and charming and funny story.
Yeah, cool. And so that's at the Parkway. And then, by the way, Blinded by the Light, which we talked about earlier, is at the Senator these days, along with a movie called Where'd You Go, Bernadette? And I've heard good things about this. This is Cate Blanchett. She's got this very interesting character, and she confides in this clip, we're going to listen to a clip, she confides about her newfound restlessness and feelings of failure to Lawrence Fishburne, who's an old associate. Cate Blanchett and Lawrence Fishburne in Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
You know, just last night, right? I woke up to pee. You know, I'm half asleep, I'm a blank slate, and then the data starts reloading. It's Bernadette Fox, 20 Mile House, destroyed, failed.
Yeah.
And it's like failure has got its teeth in me and it won't stop shaking.
You done?
Yeah.
Yeah, good, because I know you can't honestly believe any of this nonsense. As amusing as it is, it obscures the larger point, which is that people like you must create. That's what you were brought into this world to do, Bernadette. If you don't, you become a menace to society. I think there's one very simple answer to all of your problems. Get your ass back to work and create something.
Funny, Luke Spicknell is always saying that exact same thing to me. That's Where'd You Go, Bernadette? I would go to this movie just to sit in the theater and listen to Lawrence Fishburne talk. God, what a great voice. So, Anne, what do you think? I've heard a lot of good things about Cate Blanchett in particular in this movie.
Oh, she's tremendous in this film. I think it's actually worth it. It's Blue Jasmine level, this performance from her. It's really magnificent. This is based on a terrific book by Maria Semple that came out a few years ago, and it had a lot of fans, including me. I thought it was absolutely brilliant, absolutely hilariously funny. But this isn't the book, and it can't be, because the book was structured in such a fascinating way. It's almost an epistolary novel with all these different forms of correspondence and notes and forms of communication. And the director, Rick Linklater, could never have reproduced that in film. So I think for fans of the book, I just want to let them know, throw that out of your mind. Although Bernadette is still, you know, the character that I think a lot of us had in our vision when we were reading it, I think it was a difficult book to adapt, and there's a lot lost in translation. Again, a lot of contrivances. I'm not sure I quite believed it. But just the chance to kind of go on this journey with her. And it, again, and another performance by Billy Crudup as the husband and father in this narrative, which is interesting to see back to back with After the Wedding. But I was really kind of charmed by it. And again, just I just was gobsmacked by Cate Blanchett. I thought she was terrific. Mm-hmm.
Jed, how about you? I have not read the book. And it must be much, I know, much appreciated. I didn't believe a word of this movie, and I thought it was a horrible waste of everybody's talent, including Rick Linklater directing. I thought design, everything about it, I thought was a mess. Pushed hard to get to a place that just didn't earn any of the eccentricity or anything in the
well, for whatever reason, I always find myself, you know, relating to things that are a mess. I don't know what that says about me.
So I think you'll like it.
I'm into it. I'm going. Yeah, I'm going to miss that horror movie. I'm going to this one. All right, Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Hornaday of the Washington Post, our eyes on the ground in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival. Yay. Thank you to you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
So coming up after a short break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us with a glimpse of what's on the horizon in this year's theater season. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.